The fastest hour in radio starts now.
I've been tripped up. I've been all tripped up. So tripped up about the Endangered Species Act, about grizzly bear recovery. In the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the GYE, they've been recovered for over 10 years. Thriving population. There's over 700 bears there. In the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, the NCDE, there's over 1,000 bears, more likely. George Edwards from the Montana Livestock Loss Board posted on Tuesday on his Facebook page that today's claims, and these were claims that were actually processed that day, but kills that happened earlier, 29 ewes and 11 lambs. So 40 sheep killed in Toole County grizz. One calf killed in Beaverhead County wolves. Four more sheep killed in Lake County grizz. And he also posted, this year we have paid for 189 head of livestock compared to 101 head a year ago for the same time. And he's now just getting to July loss claims. And we have been beating the drum on bears. Bears on the golf course. There's bears in the bins. There's bears in the backyards. And, of course, there's bears in our courts. Must it always end up there? By all accounts, the science, the bears and the GYE, they're doing just fine. Really, aren't they? And states are ready for management. States are really kind of chomping at the bit for local management. And that's the original intent of the ESA. There's a judge's ruling last fall that tripped up the entire process. He pondered, and I think it was a pondering. In my mind, he was just kind of pondering. But because he's a judge, he's musing. It turns into a ruling. He pondered if it wouldn't be best for bear recovery to be considered across the entire six recovery zones versus delisting in the individual zones where they are recovered. The greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And along the front, the Trump administration kind of pushed back on that ruling, challenged it, and we await that decision. Meanwhile, we have bears on the golf course and bears in the bean bins and bears on our birch benches in the backyards. And, of course, still our bears are in the courts. Welcome to Voices of Montana, from Montana, for Montana. We will beat this drum again here a little bit later on. We'll change gears, talk with Gary Ween, CEO of the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. There's an issue that has them tripped up over their tax-exempt status. But right now, pleasure to welcome Jonathan Wood. He's an attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation and a research fellow with PERC. The Pacific Legal Foundation is a place where he litigates environmental, property rights, constitutional cases, and he's also the author of six law review articles on the Endangered Species Act in federal lands. And Jonathan, pleasure to welcome you here, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
As you know, I have been banging the drum on bear recovery because we're seeing a lot of conflict in the urban interface. I read this article you wrote that explained the new endangered species rules. We want to get to that. That came down from the executive branch. And that led me to a PERC policy report that you wrote last April, The Road to Recovery, both nicely written. Well done, sir. In that report, you detail the ESA's original two-step process, and I think that's where we have to start to understand this road to recovery.
Sure, yeah. When Congress passed the Endangered Species Act in 1973, it envisioned the protection and recovery of species happening in a two-step process. Species could be listed as endangered if they were currently at risk of extinction, and befitting the threats they face, those species got maximum protections. Congress anticipated and intentionally imposed really burdensome regulatory restrictions to protect those species, acknowledging that it would impose serious costs on the private landowner. But for species that face only more remote risk, which are called threatened species, that may become endangered in the foreseeable future, which may be decades down the road, Congress thought the same calculus didn't apply. So Congress intentionally didn't apply the most burdensome regulations to those species. And it did so for a specific reason. It wanted to ensure that landowners had an incentive to care about moving species from endangered to threatened and from threatened to off the list. And the way you do that is by rewarding landowners when they succeed in making those transitions. But unfortunately, since the late 1970s, the Department of Interior has had a regulation that eliminated that distinction. Just presumptively regulated every threatened species as if it were endangered, and that completely eliminated those incentives. So from the perspective of the private landowner, once you had a species on your property list as threatened, all the damage that could be done to you already had been. There was really no cost to you or no harm to you if the species continued to decline and became endangered. And similarly, there's no benefit to you if you had an endangered species on your property and it were to recover. And we can see the consequences of that policy. Over the last 45 years, the ESA has proven extremely successful at preventing extinction because of those strict regulations for endangered species I mentioned earlier. But it has failed to achieve the recovery of protected species. Less than 3% of the 1,500-plus species that have been listed under the Endangered Species Act have achieved recovery and come off the list. And I think the primary reason for that is that we have inadequate incentives for private landowners to undertake efforts to restore habitat and grow larger populations so that species can recover and come off the list.
I think we have to come back and talk about that Department of Interior decision, because that comes from the executive branch. And executive branch action is a little bit easier than congressional action when it comes to possibly reforming the endangered species list. Because, as you note in your article and in other places, it is one of the most popular, and it has been effective in some areas, but there are statistics behind that. Some say it helps save 99% of those listed species, and then there's a group that says, yeah, but only 2% of those species have actually been delisted or fully recovered. So we'll take a break and come on back with more as we bang our drum on the bears in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem as we try to get some understanding regarding the Endangered Species Act. Jonathan Wood is with us. He's a PERC fellow and an attorney with Pacific Legal Foundation. Back with Voices in a bit. I just wanted to play that song. You got any more of that, Josh? No, that's it. I just want to bang on a drum all day. Oh, dang. Okay, I'm a little disappointed at that. Welcome back to Voices of Montana, 866-627-5483. It's from Montana, for Montana. I'm Tom Schultz. We are talking about an issue that really has dominated Montana, the Endangered Species Act. It's not just the bears, but we've been focusing on that because there's been a lot of conflict with bears. But wolf recovery, sage grouse, we can get to that as well. A research fellow with PERC, and PERC is the Property and Environmental Research Center, a good group that's actually based in Bozeman, Montana, was founded in 1980, and they're a conservation research group dedicated to free market environmentalism, and Jonathan Wood is with us. He's a research fellow with PERC. Jonathan, again, I appreciate your time here. There's some amazing statistics about the Endangered Species Act, but I want to go back to where we kind of left off. If that Fish, Wildlife, and Park ruling, and maybe you can go into that in more detail, in 1975, as I recall, you said, was if it was a ruling from the executive branch and that is tripping everybody up, that's something that can be changed from the executive branch, and we've seen some action from the executive branch recently.
Yeah, that's right. The rule was issued back in the 70s, and it purported to essentially overrule Congress's policy choice, that the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Interior thought it knew better than Congress and was no longer going to honor the distinction between endangered and threatened species. And that rule has been in place for decades, and as I said earlier, you can see the effect of the rule in the low recovery rate. But what one administration or agency does, it can undo. And a few weeks ago, the Department of Interior finally eliminated that rule and returned to the Endangered Species Act as originally written and understood. And going forward, it will reserve the most burdensome regulations for endangered species that truly need it, and will instead tailor regulations for threatened species to better fit the threats they face and to provide incentives for landowners to undertake efforts to recover endangered species so that they can be upgraded to threatened and ultimately come off the list entirely.
Naturally, there's going to be areas of conflict and disagreements when it comes to these rule changes. Will these things in 5 years from now finally be settled?
Probably not. Nothing under the Endangered Species Act, it seems, ever is settled. One of the things I did when some of the press for the new rule started to come out is I went and looked at what happened when the Obama administration, George W. Bush administration, and Clinton administration proposed their own improvements to the Endangered Species Act, and it's shocking how much the rhetoric is absolutely identical. It doesn't matter what the change is, what the improvement is, the rhetoric is always the same. Everything is destroying the Endangered Species Act or kowtowing to oil and gas or big industry. And the truth is, it's never true. Most of the changes, including these, include a lot of things that are relatively modest and probably shouldn't generate much controversy. Some of them are substantive and can have a big impact, but I think on net, the new rules will promote better conservation and more recovery efforts. So in the long term, I think you'll see species and private property owners benefit, but our politics on endangered species issues are so broken at this point that I expect you'll see lots of litigation and you'll see lots of criticisms of the rule for many years to come.
Well, and that's kind of where I have focused a little bit in trying to understand this. You have the science behind it, and that should be kind of plain and simple and pure as much as it possibly can be. Then you have the boots on the ground, that ground level look where people are, and we've had them on the air here, are living with these bears and their real life experiences. We need to pay attention to that. I'm not sure we're listening. And then we've got the political side of it, the policies, which have been hard to figure through. And I think, and we'll have to take a break here too, Jonathan, and we can address this in more detail because I know you, it's been a focus of yours as well. There is a movement for cooperative agreements. There is a movement for states to get ahead of the endangered listing and stay with the threatened listing and be able to do things in that cooperative level, which maybe will lead us to this road to recovery. We'll be back with more Voices of Montana. Jonathan Wood, our guest from the Pacific Legal Foundation, from Montana for Montana, back here in a bit. Back here with Voices of Montana, from Montana for Montana. I'm Tom Schultz as we continue now regarding the Endangered Species Act, the reform, but also some new rules that came down that there are people that are complaining about it, but hopefully it will bring us closer to the road to recovery. That's an article, actually a PERC policy paper that was written by Jonathan Wood back in April 2018. It was nicely written. You can go to PERC and find that and find his writings. PERC is the Property and Environment Research Center, which is based in Bozeman, Montana. Jonathan, again, appreciate your time here. We have a little space now to kind of dig into this a little bit. Can you tell me what the difference is from maybe a scientific basis, or maybe it's not scientific anymore, maybe it's all political, from an actual endangered species and an actual threatened species so that we can get back to clearly operating under this two-step process?
Sure. So under the statute, the difference is primarily based on how immediate the threats are to a species. So if a species is currently at risk of going extinct today, it should be listed as endangered. But if the species is currently doing okay, but there are reasons to think that in the foreseeable future it may become endangered, the Endangered Species Act allows that species to be listed preemptively as a threatened species so that we begin planning and doing things to protect it before it makes that slide. Foreseeable future, a lot of those terms I just used are a little fuzzy, so there can certainly be some close cases at the margin. But the general principle separating them is, is the species at risk of going extinct today, or is this something that we can see coming down the line but isn't yet a major or immediate concern?
And a new administrative rule try to get some boundaries regarding a definition for foreseeable future, right?
That's right. One of the new rules codifies an approach that the Department of Interior has followed for the last decade for reviewing when species are listed as threatened. That policy says that you have to define the foreseeable future based on the impacts that you can determine are likely, and you can predict the likelihood of the species' effects. The basic idea is you don't want to engage in just rank speculation of asking, okay, what's the species going to look like 100 years from now based on nothing? So it directs fish and wildlife biologists to look at the science and say, okay, what's our level of confidence that what the habitat will look like in 20 years, 30 years, 50 years. And at some point, it becomes too speculative and we have to cut off the analysis. But we want to make sure we are looking forward without engaging in just blatant speculation.
Will that help prevent the theories behind, and I know there's science behind it too, climate change, but there's also a lot of postulation regarding it. Will that help prevent those from being entered into the courts as part of the foreseeable future, which could really muddy the waters?
I don't think it'll make it difficult or impossible to use climate change as a basis for listing. And that's happened quite a few times in the last 10 years under this policy when it was just the informal policy. So I expect we'll mostly see a continuation of the status quo, but you're right. The one thing it does, and this is, as I said, been the policy for the past decade, is the Fish and Wildlife Service can't just say climate change, therefore listing. They have to actually look at the science and say, how confident are we about particular impacts and over particular time frames? And at some point, we have to accept that the analysis is just, you know, too speculative and we can't go further. But that hasn't been an obstacle to list. Quite a few species have been listed based on impacts that may be 20, 30, even 50 years down the road, because they can predict with reasonable certainty what will happen over that time frame.
The Endangered Species Act, has it worked? Has it not worked? I saw statistics where, and this, I was alerted to this a little while ago, some say 99% of listed species have been helped. Others say only 2% of those species on the list have been recovered. That's quite a difference there.
Yeah, and the correct answer is that the Endangered Species Act does some things well and other things not so well. It has proven effective at preventing extinction, and that's the 99% number that you hear. Only 1% of species listed in the Endangered Species Act have gone extinct, and that number is probably too conservative, because a good number of those were likely extinct before they became listed. So I think it's fair to say the ESA has proven effective at preventing extinctions, but at the same time, we also want to recover species, and the Endangered Species Act has not proven effective at achieving that goal. Only 3% of protected species have recovered to the point they could be taken off the list, and it's not even clear that we're moving species in the right direction. The last time the Fish and Wildlife Service reported to Congress on the recovery progress of species, they found that only 10% of species were even improving. A larger number were actually decreasing or getting worse under the Endangered Species Act.
And you think there's a better way?
Absolutely. I think the key is incentives. The unfortunate thing about the Endangered Species Act is that the regulations that may be effective at preventing extinction do not encourage landowners to recover species. Essentially, what we do now is say, if you provide the last habitat for some endangered species, we're going to punish you with extremely burdensome and expensive regulations. And landowners respond to those incentives. There have been studies done to show that private landowners will manage their land to avoid the creation of habitat because it's too costly to provide habitat for endangered species. If we want to recover species and grow more habitat, we need more positive incentives so that landowners become more willing participants and partners in the efforts to conserve and recover species.
I think there's good examples of that in your report from the PERC Policy Institute, The Road to Recovery. Jonathan Wood, a research fellow with PERC, based out of Bozeman, and also an attorney with Pacific Legal Foundation here on Voices of Montana. I'm Tom Schultz. Jonathan, just to kind of continue on this vein as well, and maybe it's the burning question, I know how important and how popular the Endangered Species Act is, and I know there's hardly a will in Congress to really make changes. There's going to be legislators in the West who can pretty much argue a good case about it, but they are going to be short in numbers when it comes to getting things done congressionally. But on one hand, do we need ESA reforms, or do we need Equal Access to Justice Act reforms?
We need both. We need Congress to be more engaged on environmental issues. Congress has largely ceded the environment to executive agencies and gotten out of the business of updating environmental laws. So the Endangered Species Act hasn't been seriously updated in decades. And we've learned a lot about the incentives faced by landowners and better ways to protect species, but the law doesn't reflect that. So I know there have been lots of pushes in Congress to sort of improve the incentives under the Endangered Species Act, and I think that's important work that needs to continue. But you're right, the politics on environmental issues and the Endangered Species Act in particular are somewhat toxic. You know, if you bring up any idea to improve or change the way the law is implemented, you will be politically attacked. And this is true, you know, my favorite example is under the Obama administration, Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to change the paperwork requirement to petition to get a species listed and was accused of gutting the Endangered Species Act and kowtowing to big business. And, you know, that just reflects, it doesn't matter what the reform is, that's going to be the attack. And we have to get past that. If we want to recover endangered species, and I think everyone is seriously committed to that goal, it is imperative that we improve the law. And the Equal Access to Justice Act is part of the problem because it creates bad incentives for activists to do things that actually undermine the operation of the law. So right now, the incentive is to sue some more, because if you win a case against the federal government, they have to pay your attorney's fees. And they don't pay your actual attorney's fees. they pay a fictional attorney fee rate that no one actually pays. So there's actually an incentive. You actually can profit from suing the government under the Endangered Species Act and other environmental laws because the government pays you more to sue it than you actually paid to do the litigation.
Yeah, and that's something we've been banging our drum about and banging our heads about, too, in terms of getting real reforms. And I know how difficult that can be. Well, Congress did make some reforms when it came to wolf recovery, so it's not like it can't be done. And are there executive actions that can be undertaken? These two laws are pretty locked tight, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's probably not much the executive branch could do about the Equal Access to Justice Act. But as we've seen from the new rules, there's a lot they can do about the Endangered Species Act and the way it's implemented. Because it hasn't been updated in decades, the reality is most of the policy that gets implemented today is created by bureaucrats in the executive branch. That's just the way the law works today. I'd like to see Congress get more involved so that there's more political accountability, but in the meantime, there's a lot that the administration can do to improve the incentives to recover in the Endangered Species Act, and this rule will help them do that. So going forward, I expect to see a lot more innovative programs to protect threatened species that doesn't rely on counterproductive and burdensome regulation, but instead focuses on rewarding the private landowner who acts in the public interest and does things to restore habitat or grow species populations.
It feels like there is somewhat of a movement for people who are on both sides of the aisle regarding this to kind of come together, because I think they're realizing what they're doing is building brick walls that doesn't accomplish anything. Do you feel that in any sense?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Most of the people who are concerned about environmental issues and endangered species issues and work on them have a lot that they agree on, and there's a lot of common ground. And we talked about the grizzly bear quite a bit in today, and that's a perfect example. The work that was done to recover that species was done under Republican governors, Democratic governors, biologists at the state and federal level. A lot of conservation groups were involved in the effort. You know, that truly was a bipartisan approach that worked. The population has now exceeded its habitat's carrying capacity. And that's the model for recovering species going forward. It requires everyone getting together and pushing in the same direction. And unfortunately, too often, the way the ESA has been implemented and the way litigation tends to work, we've instead been pushing people away from each other and promoting conflict rather than conservation.
Cleaning up a few myths, and we're just really almost out of time here, but one you wanted to talk about was that economics are really not factoring into the listing of these species.
That's right. There were a lot of myths in the few days after the new rules came out about what they do, and probably the most pernicious one was the idea that going forward, species that are endangered or threatened wouldn't be listed solely because the agency thought it would be too costly and too burdensome on the economy. And it is clear the statute forbids that. The decision whether species is endangered or threatened is a purely scientific question. The new rules acknowledge that. The only change in the new rules is going forward, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Commerce can report what they think the cost will be solely for public awareness and transparency reasons. They think the policies will get better the more people know about the way the Endangered Species Act works and the cost it imposes on people across the country.
Noted author with articles appearing in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, National Review. He's a research fellow with PERC based out of Bozeman, Jonathan Wood with Pacific Legal Foundation. Jonathan, appreciate your time so much. We'll be calling again. All right, take care.
Thank you for having me.
Back with more Voices here in just a bit.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.